It's a constant in my life story that my family or me need to move from different places to access to better opportunities. So my grandparents on both sides, they were farmers. They actually didn't know how to write or read, and they moved from their own towns to Mexico City so their kids could attend school. I think coming from Mexico, I mean, a good university, but I didn't study in the best university. And when you come here to one of the, I mean, top labs in the world on this field, with when your average lab mate went to Harvard or Cambridge or Oxford, it's really hard not to doubt yourself. But that's what I thought. I'm living this life. No one in my family had the opportunity to live. That my grandparents would just be super proud and super happy. Probably they won't understand what is happening, but I think they would be like, oof, like crazy. Like, how one of us can be doing this thing called science in a different country?
Welcome to the Baker Lab Podcast. I'm Ian Hayden with the University of Washington.
And I'm David Baker, a professor here with a large lab where research happens every day. I've seen firsthand how science depends on more than just ideas and experiments. It's really about the people who make it all happen. Each episode, you'll hear from one of the researchers in my lab here at the Institute for Protein Design. In this episode, you'll hear from Susanna, who has come from very far away and made many courageous decisions about moving to new places and exploring new opportunities. Those are things that many scientists do repeatedly throughout their careers, and I think you'll enjoy hearing about how Susanna has navigated all of this. And I think you'll also be struck by how passionate she is about science and everything she does. To me, these stories prove that there are many ways of becoming and being a scientist.
I would love to hear about your early life. Where were you born? A little bit about your parents. And you also said that you think that childhood matters a lot. What does that mean to you?
I was born and raised in Mexico. It's not a town, it's actually a big city called Querétaro. We are like four siblings, and with my two parents, we were like a big, big family. And I think childhood makes a big impact in your adult life, because, I don't know, when you're a kid, you get to enjoy the world without any restrictions or rigid opinions about the world. My mom used to work she had a store in a market where she sell natural products. And I got to spend like most of the day playing outside with my friends in the market. While our imagination was like super huge, so we created like universes. And so I think I also was able to use my imagination a lot and play a lot.
Before you went to college, were you interested in science?
Yes, I want to admit that I always been like a nerd. Like, I was always very good at school, and I always had an interest for science. And I think my older sister, Violeta, she had a big role there, because when she was an undergrad studying medicine in Querétaro, she once was like, oh, come with me, I need to go to this lab. And then I remember that when I went to the lab, she was doing some neurobiology. It really like rang a bell inside my head, like, oh, I don't know what it is, but I kind of like it. And yeah, I think that really made me think like, oh, maybe I should pursue like a scientific career.
Tell me about being 18 years old in Mexico City and starting college. What was that like for you?
I think at the time I was so excited to study in the school of my dreams. But then when I felt lonely and I was away from my family and living in a very small room and not having friends, I really like struggled. And like after 2 months, I was searching on the internet how to quit my undergrad education. I have some relatives in Mexico City, and they were like, no, Susanna, you're not gonna quit. So they came for me, and then I was living with them for like 3 weeks until I felt better. And then I decided to continue. And after that, when I started to feel comfortable and having friends, oh my God, I was very happy, and like a new world was open.
What did you study in college, and did you change majors? And I'm curious what those new experiences, those new worlds were like.
Yeah, so I was studying biology for 1 year. For me, I said that a new world was open. It's because in my hometown, in my high school, the type of people that I met was always the same, and they were very similar to me, similar values, similar families. And when I went to Mexico City and I had friends, oh my God, from everywhere. Like, Mexico City is such a big place, and people have so many different backgrounds and so many different opinions. And I was just a Catholic girl who came from the small town to Mexico City, right? So even for them was like, who are you? Like, you are like a very naive person. You know, and then I switched to a different undergrad that is focused on biomedical research. Program was smaller. We were about like 10 people in my program. So it was a little bit different.
At some point in that journey, you ended up in the Netherlands. How did that happen?
So I got this email from my department advertising this congress or conference in the Netherlands where you as an undergrad could present your poster and they will pay for your flight ticket, give you money to be there, attend a conference, and even apply for some research internship. So I just did it. And I think that's a constant in my life. Like, I feel like I'm always very excited about things, even if I don't know the answer or I'm not good at it. I'm just very excited. So I applied for the program. They took me.
What was the first week or day like?
It was the first time I was outside of Mexico and I was like really shocked to see a new world. The place looks very different, and the Netherlands is a very quiet place compared to Mexico City. There's a lot of bikes. I never saw that many bikes in my life. Everyone is very punctual, very ordered, very tall. And at that time, my English was even worse than it is right now. If I spoke Spanish there, people would not understand me. So I needed to put a big effort to speak in English.
So that wasn't the only time you spent in the Netherlands, right? Mm-hmm. You ended up back there somehow.
Yes. So I found out that the same university that I went to, they offer some scholarships, especially for Mexican students, that you could apply for. It was quite difficult to get because they only offered two for Mexican students in that field. So again, I didn't know it was going to be easy, but I decided that, okay, it's very appealing for me and I already know the place. So I decided to apply for this scholarship. It was a very long process, a lot of interviews, you need to prove your English, a lot of things. But after the process, they sent me a letter where they told me that I was selected to get the scholarship. And I remember I was so happy that day. I couldn't believe that I got the scholarship and I was going to study to the Netherlands for 2 years. So I ended up there and it was really amazing. Like, I think even like the perspective on science and the level of science I was able to do there was different and also better compared to the things I was doing before.
So your time in the Netherlands, you ended up reaching out to David Baker and actually ended up here at the University of Washington as for a little while as part of your master's.
Yeah, I mean, there was this part of the program where you could do an internship abroad. And I was kind of late in the process, but most of my friends had like these awesome internships, right? Like, oh, I'm going to Stanford, I'm going to Berkeley. And for some reason, I didn't have any internship like ready. But then I decided, okay, this opportunity seems that it's not going to work out. But if it's going to work out, what is the craziest place you would like to go? So I decided to email David. Actually, through Daniel, who is a former postdoc in the Baker Lab, who is also Mexican, and he also studied at the same university than me. So I knew about Daniel.
Do you think you would have wrote to David if Daniel hadn't suggested? It's very clear that you're ambitious in that way. You're really willing to put yourself out there.
I think I was going to do it, but I was very nervous because I think it was a very different challenge. And I knew that Daniel was already working with David. So I thought he could give me more like an advice or how to do it better. And because he was still in the lab as a postdoc, maybe if David missed my email, he could bug him and tell David, this person wrote an email, please reply. And I mean, he replied quite fast. Just the fact that, you know, that person that I admire that much, like scientifically, was able to reply to my message, I was like very shocked.
We fast forward a little bit and you end up coming to the University of Washington was it a quarter?
It was a quarter, yeah. I was very excited to come here and like all of this universe of artificial proteins was something that I couldn't believe that I will be part of. So it was again, like I'm so excited that I don't think of the challenging things. It was very challenging for me, the computational side of things. If I need to give my honest opinion, I don't think I performed super great. I didn't have great results or I didn't make a breakthrough during my stay, of course. I think coming from Mexico, I mean, a good university, but I didn't study in the best university. And when you come here to the University of Washington, to one of the, I mean, top labs in the world on this field, with when your average lab mate went to Harvard or Cambridge or Oxford, it's really hard not to doubt yourself, like, oh my God, like how me, Susana from Querétaro, is doing here. I don't think I'm that good. Like, compared to them, I know nothing. But that's what I thought. But I was very, excited or happy when, before I came back to the Netherlands, I remember this very clearly. I was at the office with David, and I had two mentors at that time when I came. And then David asked me, Susana, what are you gonna do after you finish your master's? Like, what is your plan? And at that time, I was feeling a little bit down, and maybe I replied in not a very honest way, and I was like, oh, I want to pursue a PhD. But in the real, I meant that, but I was also very, like, doubting myself. And he told me, okay, why don't you come here to do your PhD? Like, I can contact you with the admissions committee here at the programs. So if you're interested, you could look at the PhD programs. And he really sent me an email with the contact information. So I was like, oh, like, he really means that. So after that meeting, I was like, oh, like, even if I don't think I performed that well, David is willing to take me for a PhD. So I thought, like, oh, I think this is a very good opportunity and I should consider that.
I think that's something that a lot of scientists struggle with, and it looks like different things to different people and they feel it to different degrees, but that idea of self-doubt, you know, if I could be performing better, the people around me are smart, and you see successful science happening and you wonder, am I that good? Is my work like theirs?
When Susana first came, obviously she wasn't an expert in protein design, but I could tell how highly motivated and how smart she was, and really passionate about what she did. And that's exactly the type of person I really like to work with and seek to recruit to our lab.
Let's talk a little bit about graduate school. You are working on a PhD. Tell me a little bit about the project that you've been up to, or projects.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a lot of, like, changes also since I started grad school. So after that year of just being a research scientist, I joined grad school, and the project that I was working on, which was related to enzyme design, was really challenging. And at that time, we didn't have AlphaFold and all of these new fancy deep learning tools that we have now. So after my first group meeting as a graduate student, David came to me and he told me, Susana, you need to find a project that, you know, you will be able to wrap up for, you know, like, to write a paper on something. So I think you should quit this other project and you need to focus on something new. So from there, I started working on protein interaction design, peptide binding design. We recently published a paper on that. So I think it was, like, actually very glad that I got to make that change, because I felt very stuck in my other project, very difficult. We didn't have good tools. Yeah, it was like I was very lost. But since I switched projects, I think I got the possibility or the opportunity to flourish as a scientist, like, to learn many things, to interact with more people, to find, like, very exciting results. So I think the peptide binding project gave me a lot of my confidence back and a lot of, like, new skills that I got to learn. And after that, because that project was done very quickly, I had the opportunity to start something new. And again, I had the freedom, like, okay, what do you want to do? Do you want to focus on therapeutics, or what's the next step for you? So I started working on a snake bite project.
Yeah. Snake bites.
Yeah. So in this, I was trying to find a project and I was reading a lot, and I came across this review on Nature where they discussed, like, how snake bite envenoming is a neglected disease and the current therapeutics are not very good. And they're actually very scarce, and they're not very, for developing countries, which are mostly affected by snake bite, there was, like, truly, like, an emergency to, like, we need to do something about this. And I got really intrigued. I was like, what, snakes? Like, how is this, like, a big problem, and how is this an emergency? So I started reading more about it. And I emailed again to David and Lance, I think I would like to work on a snakebite envenoming. And that's how it started. Like, I think at the beginning, David especially was not very excited because it's a very difficult problem. And there's many complex things in a venom that makes it very hard, like, to tackle. But yeah, that's how it started.
You use the word envenoming. What does that mean?
Envenoming is like the symptoms that you get after you get a snake bite. Like, you have a lot of toxins in a venom that produce different symptoms. For example, neurotoxins will paralyze your nervous system. Other toxins will basically eat your flesh. So like all of these physiological reactions are a product of the venoms. So that envenoming is like the process that you experience after a snake bite.
That all sounds terrible.
Yeah.
So your research focuses on that. And what are you hoping to do about it?
I truly believe that protein design has the potential to make a snake bite envenoming therapeutics more accessible for developing countries, because our de novo design proteins are very robust. They're very easy to discover only with computational methods. So that could truly accelerate the process of getting good binders or good therapeutic candidates. So I really believe this could have a big social impact just by making a therapeutic more affordable and more accessible to developing regions.
Just for a moment, let's skip all the technical details and just let's assume that this project was really, really successful. What would be the result for a normal person who, you know, is hanging out with a snake and they got bit?
I mean, the idea would be to deliver our design proteins to like high-risk communities or even like other kind of people. And if they face a snake bite, the idea would be they could administer them like as an injection and hopefully, prevent the lethal outcomes.
Wow. So it would shut down the venom and the toxins and prevent all that horrible stuff from happening in the body.
Exactly. And I think especially for developing regions, it's not only a matter of like how many people die from a snake bite, but how many people end up living with long-lasting disabilities. So these a lot of snake bite victims end up losing an arm or other limb, which really affects their capacity to work. And most of these people are farmers, so if they cannot work anymore, that kind of like makes the cycle of poverty bigger and bigger. So I think my dream would be to prevent that.
You touched on this, but I want to go back to it. You were part of this research team during a really interesting time when a whole new generation of technology based around AI, machine learning, emerged. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I was working on peptide binding design. Peptides are just like tiny proteins, let's say. And before we had the good methods, it was really hard to make proteins that could bind to these targets. But when the computational methods, such as the diffusion method, came in the Baker lab, this turned to be like very like easy or faster. So it was very exciting to see that the methods were working so well for the application we were working on. But at the same time, it was like a very hectic moment of getting all of the results. I think people on the field, like protein design, were very excited to publish their diffusion methods. But we also wanted like to be the first ones or demonstrate that our method is very powerful. So I think it was just a rush. There was no time because the method is working so great. Now you need to come up with all of the results. But it was very fast. Like all of this happened for me in the span of 2 months. And it was like, wow, like it's working really great, but it's like a very big amount of proteins that now I need to express and characterize, which was fine if I had 6 months. But in 2 months, it's like you need to have it ready.
That must have been a very busy time in the lab. Can you talk about what a day in your life looked like during that period?
I think many graduate students could relate. I think at a time I would just basically wake up, like take a shower and come directly like to the lab. Like I wasn't like really taking care of myself that much because I had so many things to do in the lab. So I used to come on during the time, not anymore. I used to come like 7 or 8 in the morning And because I had so many proteins to characterize, I came to the lab and then I started my experiments. Like I was purifying proteins, so I'm running assays all day long, probably until 8 or 9 p.m. Have like a very bad lunch very quick because I needed to go back to lab and just like keep testing the proteins until I'm done. And basically every day looked like that.
That sounds really hard.
Yeah, it was hard.
So, you know, there are maybe moments, and that was a really exceptional one, where science can be just overwhelming, right? It can feel like there's just so much to do and just not enough time to do it. Is that something you recommend as a way of working, or would you do it differently if you could? Or
I'm curious. I think I would. I mean, I think at that time, because of the, you know, of the excitement on the methods and that we needed like to share this with the world, I don't think I have any other option. I think I needed to work this hard to have the results on time, and so it could be possible. But right now, after that experience, I learned a lot of things. So I learned that you also need to take care of yourself. So that time I didn't have, I mean, maybe I could have take care of myself in a better way, but I was really focusing on science because I know it sounds hard, but I was actually very excited to see the results. Like I was very happy to see like all of these great results, but I would just take care of myself better. Maybe have like, I don't know, a long lunch break, go to bed earlier or something. So right now it's something that I'm also trying to prioritize, my physical health, my mental health, and of course work, because I really enjoy doing it. But you need to be in a good physical and mental state to perform good in your job.
I think you were being a little modest earlier when you said that you published a paper recently and you've made some molecules that performed really well, that were binding really tightly. Didn't I read that the molecules you had created bound more tightly than any molecules anyone had made on a computer ever before?
That's true. That was very exciting. I think in the protein field, sometimes you need to use additional methods to make proteins bind to their targets that tightly. But something that was very exciting, and it's part of our study, is that without using those additional methods, you can achieve very similar super high affinities just straight out from the computer. But I think it's also like a reflection or a result of the power of the computational methods that we have access right now. But yeah, I mean, it's very exciting. Like, oh, I also remember when I measured that, I was like, no, this cannot be real, right? And then I repeated, and then it was actually like that. So I think for everyone, from other people in the lab, there was a shock to see that this was possible with the current methods.
So you were doing a test in the laboratory. You had designed some molecules on the computer, like we do here. You made the molecule, and then you had to test how it performed. And in this case, it's performed well if it bound well, if it was sticky to the right stuff. So you were doing an experiment to measure that stickiness, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I remember I was like, it was like late afternoon, and I booked the machine that I use to measure this binding. And then I was reading my plate, and you can actually see the signal like real time. So I saw how it was increasing, and like I was like, what? And then I was like, no, this must be like a mistake. So I actually repeated experiment, and then I saw it was still happening. So I was like, I cannot believe that. And so there, some of my colleagues and one of the co-authors in the paper, Phil, was around at the time. And I told him, Phil, I don't know if I should tell this right now, because I think it's very like incredible. But I think we got like super high affinity binder from the computer. And he like immediately came to the lab. We look at the result and he was like, no, this is real. This is happening. And yeah, that was like very big shock. We sent an email that night to David, like, hey David, we found this in the lab. And then he like was super excited and forward to other people in the lab, and they were like, wow, this is happening. So there was a lot of excitement at that time.
I think I'm going to switch gears a little bit, if that's okay. In your opinion, What makes somebody a good scientist?
I think for me, I think being a scientist is also being like, have like good values, a set of values as a person. So I think sometimes it's more important to be kind in science, to teach, right? Maybe you don't have the best papers or the best results, but you get to teach students and these students are learning something from you. So I think kindness in science is something that is very important for me and could also, I mean, makes a scientist a good scientist. And of course, creativity and, yeah, I think creativity and kindness are main things for me.
Let's imagine there's somebody out there listening to this who maybe is interested in science and want to learn more about it and get into it, but maybe they feel like they just, it's too hard, or they don't know enough, or it's maybe it's too scary to even apply to a program or send that email, or they don't know where to start. It sounds like it many times in your life that was you, but you didn't let the fear stop you. You did contact people, you did apply to stuff, and you just went for it. So do you have any advice you'd give to someone who isn't sure where to start or is really doubting themselves?
Yeah, I think you just need to do it. But if you're doubting yourself, you could talk to some friends or close relatives to discuss this. And I think they will make you feel more comfortable and then you can do it, right? But I think my answer is you need to do it, because that's the only way you get to know if this will work out or not. So I think just do it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Baker Lab podcast with now Dr. Susana Vasquez-Torres. I'm Ian Hayden with the University of Washington School of Medicine.
And I'm David Baker, professor at the University of Washington.
This episode was recorded at the Institute for Protein Design in Seattle with help from Nora McNamara-Bordwick and Riti Biswas. Our music was by Kevin McLeod and Taylor Lidsky. Please subscribe if you like the show, and thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.